3 years ago, I worked up some notes on to follow discussion of Mao Zedong's little red book, discuss the idea of urban revolution and counter-revolution. And it was in connection with the seminar which we were running here for the Strategic Air Command. And barely got started with urban revolution. I never did get around to counter-revolution. And in the last 2 years, I've barely gotten up to urban revolution. So hopefully today we can have revolution, and Wednesday we can beat the revolutionaries that we trained today. And the purpose is not to train you in overthrowing governments or anything of that sort, but to perhaps help you somewhat to understand why certain things happen. I should possibly understand a bit better some of the things that have been coming out about our CIA activities. And most importantly, to talk about what we can do as a country to retain our freedom as a country and not to find ourselves taken over by some other country because we didn't bother to do anything about retaining our freedom. The idea of revolutionary tactics or guerrilla tactics is a very, very old idea. We got our freedom by using guerrilla tactics in the American Revolution. The British generals complained about our behavior during the Revolutionary War because so many times our soldiers didn't stand up and fight like a man. They would hide behind trees and shoot and use all kinds of forms of unconventional warfare, which was dirty pool. And meanwhile, the British Army would pick a nice big open field, hopefully sloping down, and lying there, soldiers up in their lovely red uniforms in straight lines, and then the band would start playing and they would march forward into the battle. And the Americans were all sitting behind trees and rocks and things like that and picking them off. And, they just didn't like that we didn't fight fair. Well, since then, nobody fights that way. I guess about the last time anybody tried to fight that way was in the Napoleonic Wars, and even Napoleon's battle strategy is rather obsolete today. But guerrilla warfare was what made us free. In the Civil War, probably the most successful fighting detachments were Southern fighting detachments that were guerrilla groups and that, you know, moved around from one place to another. Most of them were cavalry units, and they really made life tough for the Union Army, which was usually sitting duck. Well, these kind of tactics were developed and rendered more sophisticated in the 40s by the Israeli, who were trying to capture Palestine from the British, the Arabs, and make it a free state. And they developed two techniques. One was terrorist bombing, and the other was the Molotov cocktail, both of which made the ordinary average human being like you and me capable of inflicting a fantastic amount of damage. Now we've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. We've got 16 people here. If we knew what we were doing and were dedicated enough, we could probably overthrow any small country in the world in rather short order. You know, this number of people. There are various kinds of plastic bombs which are relatively inexpensive to make, and the instructions on making them are readily available. If we were part of the American underground rather than the overground, we'd have better access to them. Molotov cocktails are very easy to make. You just take an old bottle and you fill it up with gasoline and you jam rags in and have a little bit of rag sticking out. And when you're ready to use it, you strike a match and light it and throw at whatever it is you want to burn up. You know, nothing to it. Gasoline, even at 70 cents a gallon, that's a pretty cheap bomb. incendiary bombs. So there are all kinds of ordinary guy type weapons that have been developed. And so consequently it's becoming increasingly easy to overthrow government. And you can take the expensive way, you know, like we do CIA wise or something like that to do it. But it has become increasingly easy to overthrow governments and to destroy governments, and so consequently the subject of revolution and the subject of counter-revolution are extremely important and extremely critical. And one of the techniques that I'll get to in a little while that makes it even more important to us as ordinary people. You know, we might say, well, you know, here we are home in the village, and you know, we're going back home pretty soon, and we're ordinary Joe, and we don't work for the CIA, and we don't know anybody that works for the CIA, and there's nobody out looking for us to try to get us or anything else like that. Well, one of the standard techniques is terrorist murder. Well, you just happen to come walking down the main street. What's the main street in Minneapolis? Anybody from Minneapolis?
Nicollet.
There you are walking down the main street around Nicollet in Minneapolis, and you got a terrorist who wants to demoralize maybe the milling industry or something like that. And, you know, he gets you in the sights of his high-powered rifle and shoots you. He doesn't know who you are. It doesn't really make any difference. Matter of fact, it's better off for his purposes that he doesn't know who you are. But somebody's got to be indiscriminately shot downtown Minneapolis. And if there's no reason that's related to your existence, why you were killed, it'd be well nigh impossible for the police to figure it out or ever catch you. One of the important things that's happened in recent years also is the development of sophisticated techniques of safe guerrilla activity. That was pulling off your guerrilla activity and getting away with a whole skin. Most all of this stems from Mao Zedong. Now, we learned a few things from the Israelis, but most of this stems from Mao Zedong, because Mao Zedong spent 30 years studying the history of guerrilla warfare and developing the whole idea of the strategy of guerrilla warfare, which pretty well boils down to a few little principles, like self-reliance, where you operate on your own. You operate with materials which you can create, which you can carry around without people detecting, fairly simple plans, striking where you're not expected to strike, hitting vulnerable places. There are just a few little principles that you operate with, and you can be a very successful guerrilla. Now, guerrillaism and communism aren't necessarily coextensive, because there's fascist guerrillaism, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum. If you happen to want to destroy opposition, there are certain standard kind of ways you can do it. Right? What's the weakest kind of opponent you can have? The government. The weakest kind of form of government that you can have as an opponent is also the most efficient form of government, and that is a government which is highly centralized, has a bureaucratic structure, but has a very narrow peak. And it's easy to topple and to take over. In other words, the kind of government which looks strongest is actually the easiest to overthrow from a guerrilla standpoint. And, you know, the old Mies van der Rohe saying, less is more, put less in the building and you got more aesthetic building there. From a guerrilla standpoint, stronger is weaker. Weaker is stronger. So principles tend to work in reverse. Suppose that we had in mind now as a group that we were going to overthrow the United States of America. What should we do?
What should we try to get control of?
Media.
All right. You wouldn't try to capture the farmlands of Kansas. Some of you kind of chuckled when I said that.
Difficult to control.
They're difficult to control, and once you got control of them, what have you got?
Farmlands of Kansas. Yeah. You'd be taking something away from the government as far as getting the food products.
Extremely difficult to control. You aren't going to have it very long. They're going to come in and take it right back from you.
Hard to melt into the mountains.
Now, we're guerrilla outfits. We're not a great big army or anything. It's just us. Just this group right here.
Capture the president. Or take over. Capture him, kidnap him.
How you going to do that? What happens if you, let's say we can pull that off, we capture the president.
Vice president.
What's going to happen?
Then the vice president.
Mr. Rockefeller takes over and runs the country. So what have we achieved?
Not much.
Just made Barry Goldwater unhappy, that's all.
I'd get Al Pitcher and we'd go after the energy.
Well, what would we do about the energy?
Well, we'd take Jan Cooley for one.
Would you take it or would you do something to it?
Put a hole in it. Make it inoperative.
All right, you put a hole in it. What else would you do?
You got all your power areas around the country. If you can control the energy, the man-made energy, then you would...
What do you do to the country?
Everything is chaos.
You get... Well, what happens... Something happens first before chaos. Everything grinds to a halt. See, and then there's everybody grabbing what he can get, and that's when you got chaos. But all right, you paralyze the economy, and you thereby paralyze the government. But it's kind of hard to make a hole in Grand Coulee, even if you had a big anti-tank weapon or something like that you could wield. By the way, you could rather easily wheel a big weapon up and take a shot at Grand Coulee. There are about three different levels from which you can do it, and there's nobody around patrolling or anything like that.
It'd be much cheaper with a small group that we are to use a mortar type of shell with a long wire and just shoot it right across some of the power lines.
All right.
But you haven't got much time to act in this country.
Yeah. Has anybody tried that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Every once in a while, a power line gets shot. Well, all you got to do is take a good deer rifle with a good telescopic sight and shoot through those lines that are out in the middle of nowhere.
I don't think, though, that stopping the Grand Coulee, after all, that doesn't provide that much energy through the whole nation. You've got to stop the strike-back power first, like the way the sack bombers were in Omaha. You've got to paralyze the communication system of the military first, don't you?
All right, now how are you going to do that? Yeah, now, one of the things we got to watch here now, see, is we're kind of operating in terms of as though, we're going to have it done by supper time today. Mm-hmm. So, you can ask 30, 40 years if you want. Providing the energy lasts that long. But, we don't have to get this thing done overnight. Can we, as this size group, get it done overnight?
No.
And the first rule of guerrilla warfare is be practical. Know your limitations, know what you can do. But what do we have to do? Let's just stay in this power transmission area for a little bit. Go ahead.
I was going to be.
All right. Suppose that we...
I'd get some people into Western Electric, Transport Communication, Westinghouse, building up the works. Very
small. All right, any engineers here, electrical engineers? All right, now we're gonna get you into one of these. Well, could you get a job at Western Electric?
I think so. My specialty is electronics.
Okay. All right. We get you in Western Electric or somebody, some other company like that that produces certain kind of crucial components. Okay. And we'll have you work on
making the New York telephone system even more screwed up than it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay? I think parts are supposed to last 20 years to wear out in five. That yeah. Can't be detected.
Okay. In other words, what you're talking about now is what kind of technique?
Sabotage.
See, that's one of the kind of technique you use. Now, can you stop a plant by sabotage? Can he stop Western Electric by sabotage?
It would be a one big thing. It would not be as effective on a long range.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a nuisance.
Yeah.
Now, he can increase his nuisance value at Western Electric. Initially, he can create a nuisance by causing X number of parts not to work right.
Yeah. Right
now,
it's quality control, kind of, though.
Yeah, all right, but now you sit at nights figuring out some way whereby certain kind of parts that will be crucial, let's say in main trunk transmitters or something like that, you know, that affect a lot of systems, where they will quality test perfect, but 2 months later break down. In other words, a kind of internal crumbling device or maybe a miniaturized explosive that goes off 2 months later or somehow or other. Yeah, self-destruct, that sort of thing. But anyway, you figure out something that will mess that up. Right now, not only does he produce those problems, but if these problems start popping up, Western Electric has to start assigning more and more people to try to figure out what's wrong. And the more people you can get tied up in trying to figure out what's wrong, and the more directions you can have them running around, not knowing what they're doing, the more effective you're going to be as a gorilla.
It's a confidence factor, too, that it's destroying from the society as a whole, that they're not at all.
Okay, now let's pursue that one a little bit. Another thing we've got to do now is to get Western Electric's reputation for quality to start going down. And one thing you can do is by somehow or other getting inferior products getting out. What's another thing you can do? What causes people to lose confidence?
You maybe work on some dissension within the workplace.
How do you do that? How do you do that?
Oh, start rumors.
Sure. Yeah, but with your mouth. One of the most effective guerrilla tools you got is your mouth. You're born with that tool. Good old Eighth Commandment stuff. See? You can sabotage any outfit by rumors, can't you?
Sure.
You can demoralize, you can make people unhappy, you can make them dissatisfied. And this is the purpose of the whole rhetoric business. Is the president still beating his wife kind of arguments? Where you destroy confidence in leadership. You know, whether it's national leadership or company leadership or what it is, you destroy confidence by making up stories. And you work on people's natural tendency to believe the worst of the next guy, particularly if they envy him. And he can be a source of dissension in Western Electric. And,
I work right now for a pacemaker company, heart pacemaker, you know.
Uh-huh.
And one of the competitor's salesmen, I heard from one of our salesmen, did start a story that that people were getting hepatitis from our pacemaker, just to get business.
Oh,
you know?
Sure, yeah.
And it's people will react if you can scare people. You don't need to convince them. If you put fear into their hearts, and then they act irrationally and they begin to believe it.
That's right, sure. And they improve on your story.
Yeah.
All you got to do is plant it. People will improve on it, and by the time it comes back to you, you know, it's so credible, you'll believe it too. Sure. See, and that's the kind of technique you use to start breaking things down. Now, if we go down and blow up a power line here or blow up a power line there, you know, people start running around in circles. You blow up public John in the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. And then you blow up a John the next day in the capital of Washington State, in the State Capitol building. You know, and then a couple days later, something else blows up. Have you hurt anybody? Have you Have you made created sanitation problems for the nation? But all of a sudden, everybody's getting, you know, kind of leery, and the see your nation's capital business starts falling off, and the legislators start getting a little tense. And it costs you maybe $35-40 to blow up those three washrooms. So you can conduct guerrilla warfare very cheaply nowadays. And the trick is the unexpected. Now, who expects you to blow up a washroom? That's a stupid thing, isn't it? And yet what you think about is its psychological impact, its psychological effect. What impact it will have. Suppose that you get into the political game now. We're gonna run Paul for, we're gonna run you against John. Paul, where do your sympathies lie today? Do you like John Tunney? You want to run against John Tunney?
Well, my feelings are rather ambivalent toward him. Therefore, I'm ambivalent toward running against him.
Yeah, remember, it's for the cause. It's for the cause, Paul, and we can't back off if the finger points. We're running against John Tunney, okay?
That's a leader.
Okay, so Paul's running for the Senate against John Tunney, who's coming up for re-election. He's got a couple of right-wingers that are running against him, so we'll have to take care of the right-wingers also, as well as John Tunney down there in California. How are we going to handle Tunney and the right-wingers that are running against him?
Smear him.
Okay, we smear him. But, you know, that costs money. To print stuff and mail stuff around and so on.
We could smear him by, say, having an attempt on his life and having it look like it was done by the police.
Yeah, we can have a fake assassination attempt.
That develops sympathy though very often.
Yeah.
If he comes out.
Let's get the other guy. Every time Tunney comes out to speak, we have about 8 people there and there. Well, maybe demonstrating. People are kind of allergic to demonstrations nowadays. Maybe you stand down near the front, you know, and you just keep saying the same thing over and over again. Something that's either strange sounding or critical sounding, just over and over and over again. Every time he tries to talk, you know, you shout him down. Or you holler him down. Or you engage in some sensational things, like he's out there delivering a speech on TV statewide. And all of a sudden, some naked gal comes running out of the wings and throws herself into his arms and says, "John, honey." What's the unconscious reaction? What's people's unconscious reaction to Tunney? You know, regardless of they believe that she has anything to do with him or not. He's automatically smeared psychologically, and there's not a darn thing he can do about it, is there? There's no way he can wipe that out. So they're all, you know, the whole dirty tricks business is also, as you may have suspected, used by non-communists. But that whole business, you can work it, and it's amazing how many things you can do cheaply. You order 10,000 cases of beer delivered to John Tunney's political headquarters. You know, all kinds of things you do. You invite people to a party at his headquarters, you know, influential people to a party at his headquarters, and there's no party planned. You know, all kinds of things you can do to mess up a candidacy and to work on getting your guy in. Well, none of that gets Paul elected. And maybe we won't get Paul elected the first time, but we get some publicity. But there are all kinds of techniques that we can use. And Paul has to engage in the big rhetoric business. Like he's going to have to talk about the oil barons that are ripping off the poor American people. or he's going to have to launch a campaign against defective catalytic converters on those Detroit monsters that are killing the people of the Los Angeles area. And so on. So you have to engage in the big story. If you have a political structure, and we'd have to work with a group this size, it's going to take a long time to knock over the United States, so better work with a smaller country. Suppose that we have a little bureaucracy that's structured like this, and these are all positions and underlings and underlings and all that kind of stuff. What do you aim at?
The conversation.
I mean, what do you aim at if you want to take over?
Not even an intermediate level.
In the middle or else, you know, up near the top. You don't go for the top position. Why?
You're vulnerable.
Why are you vulnerable?
Because like, people below you can blame you for the problems.
But it's something more obvious than that.
Well, the next guy can knock you off.
Oh, yeah, sure. You're visible. You're the most visible guy in the whole outfit, because there's only one up there. So you may work for middle level, and then you can sabotage up and down. If you're in on this level, you can control from here on down. You can screw up things that come down this way. You can build on the natural jealousy of these guys, each one of which knows that he's much better to be number one than the guy that's up there. And so you can sabotage the whole works. At the same time, you preserve the structure for when you take over, the structure's intact. Then you just simply replace with your guys. It's a bit harder if you go for the top spot unless you have all kinds of power, particularly appointive power. Now, if all of these positions are appointive, imagine this is a giant patronage army. If the guy at the top controls the whole patronage structure, and assuming he's got enough people to hold all the jobs, then it's to his advantage to try and grab the top and then replace everybody with his boys, and then they've got control of the whole structure. If it isn't that way, if a lot of these positions are independent of you or elective, you got to operate differently.
Yeah, oh. A lot of underdeveloped countries are—it's such a flat hierarchy
where there's not very much of a structure.
There is a middle level to shoot at.
All right, now what do you have to do then?
Well, then you have to.
If you don't have a structure, a command structure, what do you have to do?
Well, you have to go to the top. Then you have to overthrow the top.
But before you do that, there's something you have to do.
You have to create a structure of your own.
You create a command structure that is ready to move in. And you train your command structure, then you take over, the command structure takes over, and it has a dual advantage. One, you know, you're all set and ready to go. Number two, your government works better than the previous one did, because you've got a command structure, people that know what they're doing, and after a short period of time of popular opposition, all of a sudden they say, hey, this is a government that works. Wow! See, and then you get popular support. So oftentimes, you create your potential government, and it works sort of like a government in exile. You know, you've got all your bureaucratic offices, structures, and so on, and you're all ready to go in when you can get control. In the United States, where do you have to have control in order to control the country? Rural, urban.
Urban.
That's where most of the people live. Where did Mao Zedong operate and get control?
Rural.
And through the Cuban Revolution, first rule of guerrilla warfare was pacify the countryside, right? And that's what Fidel Castro did also. Pacify the countryside. Batista's got Havana. You got the countryside. You get the peasants on your side. Control the countryside and then move in and take over. Grab the radio station, start broadcasting, you know, communication.
and have your boys sitting out along the highway shooting high power bullets into the tires of the army trucks and things of that sort, and take over. Grab the radio station, start broadcasting, more communication, and have your boys sitting out along the highway shooting high power bullets into the tires of the army trucks and things of that sort, and take over. Well, then he sent Guevara down to South America to liberate South America. And what did Che Guevara do? He went to Bolivia. Where did he head? Into the mountains. And then he's going to take over the Bolivia from the mountains. What happened?
Bolivia's mining towns.
Yeah. It didn't work. And Mao was the first one to say, you know, the name of the game now, in most parts of the world, is going to be hold the cities. Capture the cities. And so we have urban guerrilla warfare. Now, urban guerrilla warfare works considerably different from rural guerrilla warfare or from mountain guerrilla warfare. And in the United States, to try to take over the country the way Mao did, I suppose, would be to try to use Holden Village, you know, as your center. And you take over, you know, we'll take over Holden Village at supper tonight. And hold Carol Hinderly hostage. He just got back about 40 minutes ago, right, Paul? About 40 minutes ago. And we'll take him hostage and begin a new country starting with Holden Village and work our way out. And we'll word filters out to the outside world. And first thing we know is Happy Exchange gets grabbed by the Forest Service at 25 Mile Creek, and Lady of the Lake never leaves Chelan, and here we sit. Being our revolution is over. You've got to get the cities. Now, how do you get the cities?
Right now in our country, I would look at public union movement.
Right, one of the kind of things you could try to do is to infiltrate unions and get into union leadership.
So much flux right now.
What is a powerful tool of the union?
Strike.
The strike. And there are about half a dozen different unions that relate to cities that if they go out and strike, you paralyze the city. If you want to paralyze the country, through what union would you work? The Teamsters, sure, obviously. If you get control of the Teamsters, and this is why the United States government has always very closely watched the Teamsters. The Teamsters and the maritime unions, you know, the ones that unload and load ships. Because if those get controlled by a group that wants to overthrow the government, they can paralyze the country. And so they've always been very, very closely watched by the United States government. So anyway, you can, we've talked about sabotage, and now we're talking about paralyzing the city. Is a city strong or weak?
What city is weak? Because
why?
Poor community between the people living in it.
Right, there's not very good communication within the city. What else?
Trust concept, community in that sense.
All right.
We don't know our neighbors.
Right? They don't have a sense of community. All right?
They're not self-sufficient.
They're not. Why aren't they?
Because goods have to be brought in.
All right. In the city, you modify things. You don't produce things. You modify them. This is why, you know, the standard treatment of cities has always been what we saw recently at Phnom Penh. You surround it, cut it off from its supplies, and it mostly can last about 3 weeks. Now, back in the Middle Ages, a city used to be able to last 2, 3, 4 years. They could retain a water supply. But nowadays, if you completely cut a city off, I mean, even leave a water supply, at best it can last 3 weeks. But just to mention one thing, even if food's coming in, if you let all the food they want, all the food and water come in that they want, but you don't let any sewage come out, how long does the city last? A week or two. Suppose you blocked off all the sewers and they couldn't unload anything. Couldn't use their washrooms anymore. Can you imagine? You know, in a week's time, they quit. Cities are very vulnerable things. Remember when New York had the power outage? New York City? All of a sudden, paralyzed. Can't do a thing. Blow up a couple of bridges out of New York, out of Manhattan, and you know, everybody's trying to head up north through Harlem and the Bronx. The Bronx and the Harlem, rather. And fantastic traffic tied up. Or you get at the computers that control the traffic lights and you reprogram them so that lights are lasting 10 seconds and then they switch. You can really drive a city crazy in rather short order by getting hold of certain areas. Then if you can grab the national networks and start broadcasting, and then you feed them all kinds of misinformation. You tell them that your army has taken over the country and that Los Angeles already has capitulated and that more troops are arriving and the president has fled the country. You know, you can feed people anything you want as long as they have no alternative source of information. You can turn the whole country into paranoia, which disappears as soon as they find out we got bigger since we counted. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hey, we picked up 4 recruits since we started. We got 22 now. As soon as they find out there are 22 of us, it's about like the wizard and the Wizard of Oz. Remember? You remember in the Wizard of Oz at the end, they were scared stiff, all those flames and that big face and that big voice, and then the dog ran over and pulled the curtain back, and here was Frank Morgan there talking into a loudspeaker and pulling all kinds of controls. See, all of a sudden they find out that we're 22 ordinary average people. Yeah, then we've had it. So consequently, what we've got to do is recruit. And we gotta keep building support. I'd say we get big enough now that we're successful and we get control. We get control of the federal government. Now there's something else that we don't have control of. That's federal.
The military.
All right, what are we going to do about the, what will we have done already about the military?
Well,
what kind of a structure is the military?
You go for a very hierarchical.
Yeah, it's this kind of a business. Anytime you encounter this kind of a business, we know what to do. Infiltrate the middle structure and work both ways. Well, sure, so we infiltrate. What else do we do?
With military?
Do military armies tend to, you know, just switch allegiances just like that?
Promising better equipment, more control.
Yeah?
To get some people to end your side who are fairly high authorities, is that what you're getting at? That's what happened in the 7 days in May thing. There were some admirals and generals
Who
went along with the commander.
With the head of Joint Chiefs of Joint Chiefs of Staff, right? Well, there's something more than that you've got to do. So you replace, you know, the top echelon with your guys after you've taken over the country. Do you get automatic allegiance from there on down?
Yeah, you have to sift through there and pull out some of the people that are you're more intelligent, independent. I mean, you have to get your army to be more lockstep.
Right. The best thing you can do, if possible, is to replace it. Now, you disarm it and replace it with your own group. This is why Mao always advocated the development of a people's army. Now, how do we get a people's army? It's your guerrilla outfit. And so, suppose that, you know, when we get all done with a grand strategy here before supper, then the last thing we would work on would be, all right, now, each one of us is leaving this place, and each guy's on his own. Each guy and each gal is on his and her own. And each, you know, and we'll spread out around the country, and each one of us is going to develop their own little cadre of guerrillas. And, you know, we won't surface again until we've got control of the government. And so you just kind of go underground and you develop your little operation. And maybe they're kind of casual communication back and forth. But it's pretty much a self-reliance sort of operation. You get lost in the anonymity of the city. We have general kind of strategies. Maybe we make an agreement that 5 years from today we will re-meet here at Holden and see where we're at. But that's the kind of way you operate. And you have various kind of strategies and techniques that are available to you. At the same time, maybe certain of us are delegated the responsibility to begin to develop more formal guerrilla outfits. Like, for instance, maybe we have somebody go down to Arizona and join the Minutemen down there. Because the Minutemen are a lot of wealthy guys that have spent a lot of money on weapons. You know, and they train every weekend to overthrow the communists if the communists ever invade the country. You know, so you infiltrate the Minutemen. So, you know what weapons are available there and everything else, and gradually you convert the Minutemen over to a revolutionary subversive force, and you gradually convince them that the present form of government we have is just inimical to the best interests of Arizona millionaires. And so now we got a people's army at work down there in Arizona that's available. And maybe we get another one that's available. Maybe we have Texas Rangers that are available. But once we finally take over the country, these kinds of groups can function as a sort of
military police group. And then, you know, gradually become, they take over the military. And your bottom ranks usually aren't any particular kind of problem, but you set up the middle and the upper ranks with your own people. That way you take over that. All right, now we got another area of the country we don't have control. We got the government now, we got the army now, the armed forces now. What don't we have control of? What else?
I think in a large country like this, you want to get control of the money structure. And one way to do that might be to be get involved with organized crime.
Yeah, that's one alternative. The other alternative is confiscatory taxation. One way or the other way, though, you suck the money out of the private sector and into the public sector where you can control it and redistribute it in ways that will be beneficial to your kind of operation. That general sort of area was where I was going. I want a bigger area than that. Well, that's part of it. Manufacturing part of our economy, we don't have control of. What else don't we have control of?
The distribution of goods.
The distribution of goods and the production of natural goods, you know, the rural economy, the farm area. What are you going to go at first?
Wholesalers.
Pardon?
Middlemen, wholesalers.
All right, you might go to the old principle where you got a structure, grab the middle and work both ends. Yes, you can go in. You can go in there on the distribution of goods business. What do you want to take over next?
Somewhere, so you talk about...
Where else have you got structures?
Well, your educational structures can...
All right. Why do you want that?
A lot of energy can come out of there for leadership toward the people that are left more or less leaderless and... The educational system, in a way, is like a bank.
All right, now relative to education, what do you want to do now? If you have overthrown the country and are running it, what do you have to do with the educational system?
You don't want to destroy it. You want to control it.
Oh, you never destroy any kind of apparatus that is usable.
Suppress free thought
and substitute what?
Party line.
Yeah, indoctrination. So, in other words, education becomes indoctrination. Not thinking, but indoctrination. You feed them what you want them to believe. So the name of the game becomes indoctrination. Anything else you do with the educational structure?
Well, I think from an autocratic point of view, you'd want to discourage a lot of the advanced work done by people into thought process, philosophy, this kind of direction, and encourage technological training and research.
All right, are you going to encourage all thoughts about alternative forms of government?
Pick up books.
Yeah, in other words, you're going to have to institute censorship and sort of things in order to prevent any alien voices from speaking that would attack your position, what you're doing, and so on. All right, you got another kind of structure that's readily available for you to take over.
Church structure?
Unimportant.
The legal system, isn't it? You get these people accused and get them into prison. That is, you can't have...
All right, what are you going to take over in the legal system?
The courts.
All right, yeah, but you don't particularly worry about the American Bar Association, do you?
No.
No, you grab the courts. You don't care what kind of lawyers are arguing in front of the judges. If you got the judges, any lawyer in the world can argue a case. The judge will see to it that the case turns out the way you want it to. So you grab the judiciary and you get your people in the judiciary. Because then they tell people what's right and what's wrong. And they can make anything you do constitutional. And anything your opposition does unconstitutional. So if you grab the position that says what's right and what's wrong legally, you know, you have a very powerful fulcrum there.
But would you tell us how you do that?
Why doesn't it, I mean, why didn't the judges in Germany object to sentencing them to Jews to a camp or something?
Well, because it was legal. Hitler never did anything that was illegal in Germany. Now, there was a critical little business there. Hitler legally became the head of the government. He was appointed. He was appointed chancellor by the premier. The business establishment was behind him. The judiciary was behind him. The military was. I mean, they all agreed that he was the one to take. Remember the Reichstag fire? Now, you know, as we found out later on, his boys burned the Reichstag down. But at that point, this was a terrorist tactic. And the Parliament of Germany was so scared by that that they declared a state of emergency, voted him extraordinary powers, and suspended the Constitution. And that state of affairs remained to the end of the Third Reich. So anything Hitler did from then on was legal.
So the judges themselves could rationalize it.
Well, once they rationalized it, if they operated consistently, they had to find for him. Now, very few of them ever said what he is doing is legal but immoral. See, now, as far as, you know, there was virtually no sentencing of Jews to concentration camps. They simply rounded them up and took them off. They didn't have their day in court. That was only in the very, very early days, in the middle 30s, just before the war, that any ended up in court. But once, you know, they started hauling them off in numbers to concentration camps, they just rounded them up and took them. They suspended habeas corpus rule, you know, and various of the other standard legal rules. It just suspended. State of emergency, these things are suspended. Then they could do anything they wanted. And
so
it was all perfectly legal.
Here, if our Congress did that for the same thing, we're talking about taking over the U.S. government now.
All right, now you know that our Constitution allows that in a state of emergency.
It does?
Well, yeah, in a state of
emergency. Suspension of even the freedom of speech and such?
Yeah. Matter of fact, President Roosevelt during World War II had the authority to do almost anything he wanted.
Well, we should change that.
Whatever the Alien and Sedition Acts under Adams.
This is, you know,
well, Wilson
remember
had
what
too,
we did. Remember what we did with the Japanese.
True, yeah. But those things were declared unconstitutional later. What I'm getting at is that if we took over the system where even if Congress voted an emergency act, whereby the whole country is under martial law, for example, aren't Berger and them obligated to speak up and to say that this is...
Yeah.
So it's still legal now to have internment camps. But after they have to...
We still have a law on the books. That law that authorized it is still on the books and hasn't been removed.
Well, one thing may be helpful, too, is just you know, before you start thinking about what the judges did say to Jews there, think of what the judges in the South did to people who were blacks 5-10 years ago. And Hitler was playing on natural prejudices among German intelligentsia and judiciary against a race of people. So, you know, it's not that hard to conceive.
Now, it's about time for us to quit, and we've covered most of the topics I've got down here. But let me point out something to you all. You are not very good revolutionaries. Like, you're worrying about doing things legally. That's bad. We don't worry about law. We worry about being successful, see, and getting away with it. Now, if doing it the legal way is the way to do it, fine. But now, let's not worry about law and order and so on. See? Now, that's part of the game that's very difficult for us to think that way, because that's not the way we are. But we have to think that way in order to think how we're going to overcome people that think that way. See? Which is what our job is for Wednesday. Because now we've got to figure out how we can beat us. You know, Monday's us. on Wednesday, because on Wednesday we'll be concerned with the question of counter-revolutionary activity, and, you know, by people like us, not by the CIA or the FBI or something like that, but what can we do to prevent takeover of our government, either by people from inside or people from outside? And that'll be our topic. Tomorrow, Raoul Tweed is going to be talking about Mark Twain at this time, and which should be kind of fun, and then he will be talking about several other people. Joan, do you remember who he's talking about on Thursday? I know he's doing C.S. Lewis on Friday.
Martin Luther King.
No,
I don't think so. Somebody in the English literary tradition. But anyway, Raoul and I are sharing the 4 o'clock time, and he should be kind of fun tomorrow, and I'll look for you on Wednesday to tell me how we can lick the revolutionaries.
Thank you, Bill.
Keep going.